Well, welcome. Usually, in the recent past, the meeting starts at, the class starts at 7:15, but in the schedule it says 7:30. So we compromised by me walking over at 7:25. So somebody may appear, you don't know, but given, oh, we should decide what time it is. In the classes, since everyone is here, presumably, that is going to be in class, we can just say we start at 7:15. I like starting at 7:30 better, but 7:15 is fine that we leave earlier. So, okay. So as you know, the subject for our class is Dogen Zenji's Genjo Koan. I've given a class several times in the past on this subject, and I think it's really good to keep renewing so that newer people will have access to Dogen Zenji's teaching. Genjo Koan, of course, is the touchstone, considered the touchstone for all of Dogen's teachings, all of his Shobo Genzo, which is the various compilations called Genjo Koan, called Shobo Genzo, which is the collection of Dogen Zenji's writings. It's unusual for a Zen master to do so much writing, especially one who talks about non-verbal communication. But nevertheless, Dogen doesn't consider his writing as writing in the usual sense, actually. When we read Dogen, Dogen's pretty difficult, you know. Anytime you start reading any one of Dogen's fascicles, it's very difficult to penetrate what he's talking about completely, and he takes you to various places which are difficult to understand. So when we read Dogen or study Dogen, I would say read, best way, you know, is to just not try to figure it out. Dogen takes you on a kind of journey through his mind, through his big mind. It's actually like being inside of Dogen Zenji. And we just follow the way he expresses himself. So it's not like writing a novel or something that is interesting in some way or another. Each line, each paragraph, each sentence is expressing the Dharma in a certain non-dualistic manner. And so, you know, Genjo Koan is the name of this fascicle. Genjo means something like manifesting in the present, or presently manifesting, that which is presently manifesting. It's like just now, or just, or this. Koan has various meanings. In usual sense of koan collection, of various koans or encounters of the old masters with their students and other people. These koans are the expressions of the master's understanding in a total non-dualistic way. So, and you know, the origin of the meaning of koan seems to be like a public case, you know. If you're a lawyer, you go to the precedents, in order to verify or get some picture of how to deal with the case. So the koans of the old masters are like precedents. You go to study them in order to see what do they think about Zen or life or enlightenment. This Genjo koan of Dogen's, the koan, meaning a koan, you can look at it a little bit differently. Ko means like even or equal. And on means like a position or a particular position. Like, in a vertical hierarchical sense, you can say on means the position of each thing in this, the position of each thing on this horizontal plane. So, on is like vertical or hierarchical, and ko is like even or equal. In the case of Genjo koan, the equality within differentiation and the differentiation within equality, where they meet is your koan every moment. So if we have a vertical line and a horizontal line, right where they meet, that's called mind, big mind. That's what we call now, or the present manifestation. And that's true every single moment. So every moment arises as a new moment within the moment that is not subject to change. In other words, the eternal moment of always, which is always now, and the ephemeral moment, which is continually changing. Now and then. I love Sesame Street. You know, when I don't know how it is now, but when my son was a boy, I remember at the break, during Sashin, I would go, I used to live upstairs there, that's where we lived. And he'd be watching Sesame Street. And this is the word now. This is the word sit. This is the word walk, step. You know, it's very simple. They're teaching Zen. Now, I'm going to make a little adjustment here because the end of my toenail goes into the mat and hurts. So I put my little kitten under there. Bob brought this back from Nepal. He makes these in Nepal. And so it goes like this. But I use it this way. Raise my toenail a little bit above that. There. So Genjo Koan has been translated and commented on in many ways by many people. And back in the 70s, Maizumi Roshi, when he was the abbot at L.A. Zen Center, he and Daido John Lurie was at that time was a photographer and a student. So they put together this wonderful book of Genjo Koan translation and commentary by Maizumi Roshi with photographs by Daido John Lurie. It's way out of print years ago. But I use it a lot, and it's got all my notes in it. So, but there are other translations, and you have this translation, which I gave you. So that's the one I will work with comments from other translations or from other commentaries. So there are certain key words that I think it's good to remember. And a phrase that Maizumi used was intrinsic and experiential. When we look at the elements, the fundamental elements of our life, there's the intrinsic and the experiential. So intrinsic means Buddha nature, or that which is the fundamental. That's what's intrinsic. Our true nature is intrinsic. Experiential is like what we experience, right? Our thoughts and feelings, the five skandhas, and all the dharmas take part in our experiential life. So, how do we put all that together? That's what Genjo Koan is about. How do we put the essential and the experiential together? How does that all work? Nobody knows. But Dogen will give us some point to this problem. Actually, you know, since our practice is based on Dogen's teaching, he was born in the 13th century in the year 1200, as a matter of fact. So it's easy to tell how old he was by just the year, you know. When in 1225, he was 25 years old. So he lived to be 54 or something like that. So not very old. But he went to China and brought back what he felt was the true Dharma from China to Japan. He felt that Japan was the practice in Japan was too intellectual and scholarly, and although they had a lot of practice, you know, the Tentai school where he practiced when he was young. Was an eclectic school. Tendai school, and just like Buddhism in China now, or the way it was before the revolution, China amalgamated all of the practices into one practice, and under the aegis of the Tendai school. Tentai is the eclectic school. You can find all the practices of Buddhism in that school. And that was a dominant school in Japan that was transported to Japan. and the Shingon was the other one. So Dogen was not satisfied with that practice. He was searching for Zen. So he went, I'm making a long story short, so he went to Japan and brought back
China.
I'm sorry, he went to China and brought back Tsao Dung, or what we call Soto school teaching. And established the school there. Of course, Keizan, who's the fourth patriarch, actually established the Soto school, but Dogen brought back the essence. So we usually study Dogen as the essential teacher. So when Dogen came back, he wrote this Genjo koan for a lay student, but it is the touchstone. Whatever you find in Genjo koan, he expands in all the other classicals. So he uses, you can, if you study Dogen to any extent, you can see where each classical kind of has its origin in Genjo koan. So I just want to look at my notes a minute. So Dogen is presenting the fundamentals of the Mahayana teaching as the basis for his Zen. So that's why, you know, Mahayana teaching is includes Buddha nature as the fundamental basis for existence. So he lays out four sentences, and so I'll read the four sentences and then talk about them, and then we can have a discussion. So I'd like you to say, unless you have a real fundamental question, to say the questions for after you, at the point where I'll say, do you have any questions? So here's the way Dogen starts out the Genjo koan. When Dogen, in almost all of his fascicles, the opening statement is the main subject, and then the rest is the commentary. So these four statements are the fundamental, the rest is commentary. So he says, when all dharmas are Buddha dharma, they are enlightenment and illusion, practice, birth and death, Buddhas and creatures. When the 10,000 dharmas are without self, there are no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, no life, and no death. The Buddha way leaps clearly beyond being and non-being. Actually, I kind of interjected something, but I'll read what it is. The Buddha way transcends being and non-being. Therefore, there are life and death, delusion and enlightenment, creatures and Buddhas. Nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment and weeds spring up with our aversion. So, in the first sentence, the word when is important. It's been translated as, in other words, as a given, or always, but actually the word when is agreed upon. It. The word when means at the time, at that time, at a time. Now, at a time can mean when one opens one's eyes, when one has some enlightening experience. At that time, one realizes this. That's the meaning of when. Seems to be the meaning of when. When one realizes all dharmas are Buddha dharma. There are enlightenment and delusion, practice, birth and death, Buddhas and Gurus. I don't like to say life and death. I usually like to say birth and death, because in this case, birth and death are opposites. And if you say life and death, life is bigger than what we consider life. For me, life is bigger, is more inclusive than what we usually think of as life. We think, well, now that you're dead, there's no more life. But that's seeing life in a dualistic sense as the opposite, in a very small way, actually. So birth and death, birth is a process, and death is a process, even though birth is birth and death is death. But life includes both birth and death, from my understanding. Life includes both birth and death, because birth and death is a duality, whereas life is not. So I like to say birth and death. And a lot of translators translate it as birth and death as well. So at the time when we realize that all dharmas are Buddha dharma, there are enlightenment and delusion. Enlightenment and delusion, of course, are a duality. We think that enlightenment is the opposite of delusion, but that's just a dualistic understanding that diminishes both enlightenment and delusion. And then he says practice, but there's no opposite to practice. Here you see, practice doesn't have an opposite. So that's interesting. And birth and death are opposites, and Buddhas and creatures seem like opposites. So we have three pairs of dualities, and then we have practice as standing by itself. So he's presenting, people say, that there are three different ways to observe these three statements, or these four statements. One is I don't want to talk about that. I just want to talk about what I think. So, what the way that most Dogen scholars think about this. So, we can think about this as the water and the waves. So, intrinsic is like the water. And experiential is like the waves, right? Our life is, the water is one whole being, and the waves are its expression. But the waves are also the water, and the water is also waves. So this first sentence is talking about waves are waves. Genjo koan as waves. In other words, genjo koan as our life of activity, where Buddha nature is hidden. and only the waves are revealed. It's like the movie screen and a movie. This is about the movie on the screen. When the movie comes on the screen, you don't see the screen. You only see the movie, right? But without the screen, there's no movie. So this is Genjo Koan as the movie. Nothing wrong with it, actually. He's not criticizing it. He's just saying, this is Genjo Koan as the movie, as the activity of our life, as drinking tea, as cutting firewood, walking, scrolling, whatever it is that you're doing. That's our life of activity. Where, and practice. Excuse me. Practice includes all these dualities. So, this is the duality of non-duality. Because non-duality is the intrinsic reality. So then, when the 10,000 dharmas are without self, there are no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, no birth, no death. So this is emphasizing the ocean. This is focusing on the ocean. This is like the first one is emptiness is form. Of the Heart Sutra. This sentence is form is emptiness. All form is just emptiness. No self. No self means emptiness. Buddha nature means emptiness. Empty of what? Empty of inherent existence. This is the ocean without the waves. When we sit zazen, it's the ocean without the waves. There are some waves, you know, there are waves, but not much. It's as close to that as you can get to no waves. And then when we step out, it's waves. We just consider it the waves. But here, it's just the screen without the movie. And then the third sentence is, the Buddha way, now I'm going to read it according to a different translation. Instead of saying transcends being and non-being, Dogen actually says, the Buddha way is leaping clear of the many and the one. Leaping clear of the ocean and the waves. In other words, no ocean and no waves. The waves are the ocean, and the ocean is the waves. This is the last of the five ranks. This is the kind of, you know, if you study those of you who have been studying the five ranks, you will see that he includes those in a very subterranean way throughout the Genjo Koan and the Genjo and the Shogun Genzo. Although, I always suspected, and I'll read you a little something from Thomas Cleary, one of the commentators and translators. He says, Genjo Koan is one of the most popular and oft quoted essays in Shogun Genzo. Written to a lay disciple, it contains a number of key points stated in a more concise fashion. The very first paragraph contains a complete outline of Zen in a covert presentation of the so-called five ranks, or Go-In Koans, device at the original Chinese serpent's head school. The scheme of the... Oh, sorry, that's me. That's me leaning forward.
You can turn it down, sir.
No, yeah, can it back up?
You can turn it down.
Okay. the scheme of the five links, the relative within the absolute, the absolute within the relative, coming from within the absolute, arriving in the relative, and simultaneous attainment in both relative and absolute. So that's the third sentence here. So, simultaneous expression or in the relative and the absolute. So sometimes people think of this as a progression. You start from the first one and then there's the second one and the third one. But that's not Dorian's intention, to make a progressive from delusion to enlightenment. That's not what he's saying here. What he's saying here is that these are three ways that we observe how things as it is. Three different viewpoints, which is the same as with the five ranks. Even though Aquaman makes a progression from delusion to enlightenment, Dogen here is not doing that. He's just saying these are three aspects, three ways of viewing both stillness and activity as Genjo Kōan. So that's why Suzuki Roshi, when he talked about Genjo Kōan, said Genjo Kōan means our life as as it proceeds from Zazen into daily activity. And we always talk about that. I never would have wanted to say that we're talking, you know, since this is Dogen's teaching, and expressed to us through Suzuki Roshi's understanding, you know, this is what Suzuki Roshi talking about all the time with Dogen's teaching, without saying that's what it is, but expressing it through ways that he felt that we could understand it. But he never said, and he did talk about Genjo Kōan a little bit and Dogen a lot, but he never said, never was systematically talking about it. We put together actually Michael Winger and I, mostly Michael, put together a composite of his various things that he said about Genjo Kōan into a kind of lecture. But he never gave a systematic lecture about it. But everything he talked about was coming from this understanding. which reminds me that we put together a book of three talks on Genjo Kōan. Uchiyama Roshi comments, and Suzuki Roshi's comments, and Nishiyari Bokusan's comments, three Japanese commentators, and Kaz Tanahashi and I translated the Nishiyari Bokusan, who was a he died in 1910 or something. So that should be an interesting set of commentaries. that'll be published this year, I think, later this year. So the Buddha way transcends being and non-being. Therefore, there are life and death, delusion and enlightenment, creatures and Buddhas. So one way of looking at these three sentences, there's a very famous a quote saying that before engaging in practice, when you observe mountains, mountains are just mountains. And when you observe rivers, rivers are just rivers. Right? When you engage in a practice which in which your observation becomes enlightened observation, mountains are no longer mountains. Rivers are no longer rivers. Nothing is what it seems. Then when you re-enter the world, you see, oh yes, mountains are just mountains, rivers are just rivers, but with a difference. So that gives us some feeling for these three sentences as well. One sees them in an enlightened way. And the third, but when one sees them in an enlightened way, the first sentence is saying things in an enlightened way, and the second sentence is saying things in an enlightened way. So usually we think about that the experiential aspect is delusion, and that the intrinsic is enlightenment. But that's simply a dualistic split. So we don't try to get rid of ignorance or duality or delusion. Delusion and enlightenment are two sides of the same coin. So, you know, it's like a fish can't live in pure water. Matter of fact, that was in the newspaper not too long ago. Somebody put the fish in pure water, but the fish couldn't live, of course, because you can't live in pure water. So we say purity is only to be found in the impure. So it's time to take our 5 minutes of 3 minutes, actually. Now standing up, if you want to quietly without speaking. Talk about the meaning of the word dharmas here. As you remember, if you took the last class, we talked about the 100 dharmas of Vasubandhu, and what the meaning of dharmas is. Some of you are familiar with that, and maybe you already know what that means, but dharma with a capital D and dharma with a small d. So, capital with a dharma with a capital D is intrinsic. Buddhist teaching, Buddhist understanding, reality, or truth. Dharmas with a small D are all the constituents, both psychological and physical and mental. Of our makeup. So when we talk about a self, we don't talk about that there's an actual self, we just talk about there are dharmas interacting with each other. And there's no self in the dharmas. In a large sense, everything is dharma. I mean, you can talk about all phenomena as phenomenal existence as dharmas. But specifically in Buddha dharma, we're mostly interested in the human, how our lack of understanding of how dharmas cause suffering is the focus. So we study, you know, the dharmas. We study greed, dharmas that are conducive to greed, dharmas that cause, that are conducive to suffering, dharmas that are conducive to ill will, and dharmas that are simply delusional. So this is called Buddhist psychology sometimes, and all the physical dharmas as well. So eyes, ears, nose, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch are all dharmas. Hate, love, all of the aspects of good will, all the aspects of bad will, evil will, all the aspects of the human composition. Each one of those is a dharma. But Buddha Dharma is about how to let go of suffering caused by not understanding how the dharmas work together. when we study Vasubandhu's 100 dharmas, they also included the 8 levels of consciousness, the line of jnana, ego consciousness, and so forth, and how this all works together to create the human sense of self and ego and suffering. So Dogen says, when all dharmas, that's what he means. But all those dharmas are Buddha Dharma. When we realize that all those dharmas, good, evil, neutral, they're all Buddha Dharma. Each one is not outside of Buddha Dharma. Suzuki Roshi, you know, people would say, they would complain, you know, like about some like unworthiness in themselves. Like, you know, I'm so tired, you know, that I can never, I can't really sit zazen properly because I'm so tired. And you would say, oh, tired Buddha. Or I'm so weak, oh, weak Buddha. Right? So Buddha is there with everything, with all dharmas. All dharmas are Buddha Dharma. And then he says, when the 10,000 dharmas are without self, this is like a realization that all dharmas are without self. Without self means no inherent existence. All dharmas depend on everything else. So every dharma is dependent on everything else. There's nothing that exists in this world that is not dependent on everything else. You can't pull the plug. You know, I remember the figure saying, you throw a stone, but you can't throw a stone outside of the universe. There's no way that anything can be thrown outside of the universe. So it lands somewhere and it has its dharma position. Every dharma has its dharma position. That's experiential. As we are a makeup of dharmas, each one of those dharmas has its dharma position. And we have our dharma position in the world. And the world has its dharma position. In the intrinsic matrix of things. So everything is Buddha nature. That's what he's saying. So then, Buddhist, and then the Buddha way transcends being and non-being. It transcends dharmas, dharma and dharmas. Therefore, there are birth and death. You know, after you realize that the no self of things, then you see the self of things. You can accept the self of things. When you realize that the self of things is not a self. Before, when I talked about those three positions, before realization, rivers are rivers, mountains are mountains. You just take it for granted. There's the mountain, and there's the river, but you don't know what they are. We just see them in one aspect. That's a mountain, oh, that's a mountain, that's a river. But that's not seeing them as it is. We have to see them as a river is not a river, a mountain is not a river, a mountain. A self is not a self. And then when we realize that, then we can see, oh yeah, the self is, we can say, oh yeah, how are you, Joe? But you know that Joe is just a collection of dharmas. Strangely enough, that everything is totally interdependent and dependent on the whole universe. There's nothing that you can take away. So, you know, if you don't understand the meaning of this, you shouldn't hear it. But when you understand the meaning, you realize that you can't kill anything. This is the meaning of don't kill in the precept. Nothing can be killed. There's no such thing, because nothing is really born. But this can become an excuse for killing. So that's why I hesitate to say this. But the fact that it is like that. Dharmas manifest. Human beings manifest, animals manifest, trees manifest. But everything manifests in relation to everything else, nothing by itself. You know, if we all sit here breathing, saying air, and well, all these lungs are going like this, all the blood and everybody's veins are coursing through the body. We're all doing the same thing, but we're not doing it. We're really not doing it. It's just doing. The universe is expressing itself in this way. But still, you're there, I'm here, we're doing stuff. We have to understand the complete thing, and not just part of it. We get caught up. So, Dogen then says, nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment, and weeds spring up with our aversion. Now this is a sentence which doesn't need explanation. This is like the first three are like giving the story, and this is like what actually happens. So if you have any questions, now's the time. Marie?
If the first three sentences are the movie, on the movie screen?
No. The first sentence is the movie. The second sentence is the screen.
What's the last sentence?
The last sentence is the movie and the screen.
the third sentence or the last sentence?
Well, the third sentence is Shinit.
The last one.
No, the fourth one?
Nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment. Okay. What is that one?
What do you think?
I don't know, so I'm asking you.
Well, I'm sure you don't know.
It doesn't seem like it could be the movie or the screen.
No, that it's our experience. It's our actual experience in our life. That even though it's like, it's about suffering. But even though it's, you know, Buddha says, we suffer when we don't have what we want, we're not with people we want to be with, we are with people we don't want to be with, we get things we don't want. You know, we're in a situation we hate, we're not in a situation we love, and so forth. So, that's what this is saying. It says, flowers, even though we want to hold on to flowers, they fall. And even though we don't want something to come up, it comes up. This is the life of suffering. That's our experience. Not having what we want, and having what we don't want. Yeah. Denise?
When I
you have to speak up, because
okay.
I'm hard of hearing.
Maybe it's not a question, it's just how I perceive this poem written by Dogen, and it's basically he's describing some stages of enlightenment.
Okay, what?
He's describing this is my own commentary on this.
Yeah, he's describing. I just didn't hear what you said. That's all.
Yeah, I said this is feels funny yelling. This to me is a description of different stages of awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one is when it's a stage when the person sees all phenomena as the Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of an overlay to do that, to just experience things directly without any overlay,
mm-hmm.
is to experience them directly. But the person is seeing them as all phenomena, as the Buddha Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
In the second stanza, so that's still a duality. Actually, even though it's a beautiful one,
mm-hmm.
it's still a duality. And then the second one, this is like emptiness. So they're kind of returning to emptiness. It's kind of hard to decipher between the second and third one, but it's like a dropping away of any kind of, you talked about self, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is this profound sense of oneness that mm-hmm. comes forth.
Well, that's right. That's one way of looking at them.
Well, I'm going to tell you the rest of my way of looking at them.
Uh-huh.
So the third stanza is like this profound sense of oneness. There's no this and there's no that, and yet at the same time,
mm-hmm.
there is still life and death and delusion and enlightenment.
Right.
But it's all pervaded. Like there's no right. duality there.
Right.
And then the last one is actually because even if you have this awakening experience, you're going to be involved in cultivation. We often think that there's some kind of nirvana is like some final state,
mm-hmm.
but actually awakening is followed by cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
And so flowers fall with our attachment and we spring up with our aversion means that still, even after we've had this kind of awakening, suffering arises,
mm-hmm.
unresolved kalesas arrive,
mm-hmm.
and so we're back into practice of cultivation in a sense of awakening and resolving, letting go of those kalesas by, if we are attentive and aware, can do it at the root of awareness.
Well, yes. but Dogen sees these as all being equal, not as three different stages, but these are the various these the just three.
One is not better than the other.
One is not more enlightened than the other.
And that's correct, because the last kalesa to leave us is the act of comparing mind. Some person thinking they're better or worse, or in relationship, or equal. Better, worse, or equal. So, yes, all these stages there's no higher, lower, different, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though. Yes.
It's pure in itself.
I can't. Where are you coming from?
I said, I don't know, my word is maybe not the right. Probably I can find. It's pure in itself. Each situation has its own purity to it. There's no higher or lower or equal. Everybody's where they are.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's that, and then he's saying, nevertheless.
Well, the nevertheless is that because that's not the third stanza is not a there's even if that experience occurs, there's cultivation that happens
mm-hmm.
after.
Mm-hmm.
After an awakening, these things happen. The kalesas still resurface. And that involves cultivation after that kind of awakening.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're Dogen, it's not cultivation after awakening. Cultivation or practice itself is awakening. Is enlightenment. That's why he can. All three of these are.
Sure.
Are three different ways of seeing practice enlightenment.
If there was a Theravadan in the room, they would argue with you intensively. But since I come from the Mahayana tradition, I will not argue with you.
That's okay. But thank you. I think that's a good observation. Those are good observations. I appreciate that.
My first response before you said your commentary on the last statement, on the fourth statement,
mm-hmm.
Was a sense that the first three were an absolute truth, and the duality of non-duality, and the non-duality of duality, and
relative truth and absolute truth.
Yeah, yes. and the relationship between them, and then the fourth seemed to say to me, "But what we do still matters."
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering how if you can read it both ways in terms of it's our experience and our suffering. We don't have what we want, and we have what we don't want, but also that with attachment we cause flowers to fall. With aversion, we cause these to spring up.
I think that this is an interesting little koan, because it, you know, it can mean anything, you know, not anything, but it can mean any of the things that we think about in our life, how what happens to us happens, you know. The first sentence is like the relative truth, and the second sentence is the absolute truth, and then the third sentence is the relative absolute and the absolute relative, and then the fourth one is flowers fall, heat spring up. This is like the stuff of our life, you know, just stepping into it.
So, would this be like the last picture in the Oxford and pictures?
Um, Which one?
Coming back after realization.
Coming into
the marketplace. I know that. I mean, it's in reference to
the before realization, mountains and rivers are almost like.
Coming back to the marketplace is like coming back without any hang up, right? So it would refer to coming back into the place where flowers are falling and weeds are springing up.
Yeah. But you would come back with a realization of Buddha nature being there.
Buddha nature.
Where it wasn't before.
Right.
In your
well, Buddha nature is always there.
No, in your understanding.
Right, with understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With realization. Yeah.
Well, I don't know what Dogen had in mind, but how I hear that fourth statement, or what it means to me, is that even though we may have some great understanding of duality and non-duality, that the problem of desire and craving is so big that's the major, even though you may understand all of this, still the power of craving is so big that we really need to deal with this.
See, that's interesting, because this little koan, flowers fall, is different for everybody. And everybody has their own meaning. Right? So you can't say it means this or it means that. It means this to me.
Well, so what does it mean to you?
I just said. So because Marie asked me, so I answered. It means that even though I want something to be a certain way, that's not the way it turns out. And even though I don't want something to be a certain way, it comes out. And how do I deal with that? So the question is, how do you deal with that?
But why would he link that to the first three? Why would he even bother to say all that?
Because the first three are theoretical. Mm-hmm. Theoretical, in a sense. And the fourth one is the actual elder stepping off the 100-foot pole.
Could you say more about how to study this without trying to figure it out?
I wouldn't say you shouldn't try to figure it out. What I'm saying is that when you read it, you know, when we read it, it's good to just kind of go through his mind. Then you come back and read it and go through it. The more you go through it, then it reveals itself. Mm-hmm. So I would say the way to study it is to let it reveal itself. And of course, you know, this is just an attitude. It's not... And that's not a method. You know, I'm not talking about a method. I'm just talking about an attitude of letting Dogen going through his roller coaster and letting it and absorbing it and let it inform you from inside. Say, oh, now I know what that means. But yeah, you can say it any way you like. Who's back there? I can't see.
Here.
Go ahead.
I just have one comment on the three lines, or the four lines, rather. The first three are really heady and philosophical, but the fourth line is poetic.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if he wasn't playing with the... You know, you talked about the criticism of Japan before he went to China.
Uh-huh.
And I just, that's just a just throw that out there. I don't
know. Well, what is it that you're throwing out?
Well, I'm saying that maybe he's saying these three really heady intellectual and philosophical things, but then in the end he says, you know, I still feel, and I still have the flowers still fall, and I'm sad about it. Mm-hmm. And weeds still spring up, and I'm unhappy about that too. That
could be. Whatever you think.
Right.
Whatever you think is right for that too. But I wouldn't say that it's heady and philosophical. I think it's just difficult to put your head around it, around some of these things, unless you really, if you have some background in Mahayana, then it's easier to see what he's talking about. But still, Dogen has his own way of speaking, he takes you to deep places, and you can say philosophical, but it's philosophical in a sense. It has the quality of being philosophical, but I don't see it so much as intellectual, although the intellect is there, but I think it's deeper than the intellect. It's deeper than intellect, and it's deeper than just philosophy.
Well, also because he is a poet.
And he's a poet, yeah.
He's a poet, and so it has this, like, metaphorical aspect.
So each one of these sentences has its poetical aspect as well, so to speak.
Reading the text has the feeling for me of listening to a difficult piece of music first time. And you listen to it and you don't make judgments about it or even try to understand it.
Yeah.
Just let it go through you. Yeah. And then you hear it again and again and you listen until you think you understand it. And then the more you listen to it, it begins to fall apart again. And you don't understand it. But you keep hearing it over and over again.
I think that's very true. Very true. I remember when I was in art school, when I was about 20, and I went home to L.A. to my parents' house, and there was nothing to do there. You know, I laid in bed, and I laid down, and I listened to Bartok. It was about 1950. So, and you know, that was really unintelligible to me. His quartets and stuff. You know. And I just stayed there and listened and listened and listened all summer. And it all just opened up for me, you know. Just by becoming familiar with it, familiar with the language, and hearing parts that were going together, and dissonances that actually were consonances, and so forth. It all just opened up, you know, by just staying with it. But there was no way I could figure it out.
So, in the first sentence, we've got practice.
Yeah.
So it's part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's no more practice in the second sentence or in the third sentence.
Mm-hmm. So that's right.
Where'd practice go?
Well, it's implied. I think it's just implied. But that's a good question. I understand the question. The first sentence, it's the practice within duality. And the second sentence is the practice in non-duality, of non-duality. And the third is the practice of duality within non-duality and non-duality within duality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the practice is implied in the other two.
Okay. So, I'm struggling to move beyond my linear mind and not see these as steps, but
would the metaphor be that they are as if they were simultaneous universes that and one could at any moment focus into one of these universes or take one's lens and focus on this way of looking at it or that way of looking at it or that way
of that's what the three are, the three universes. The first is the universe of form, the second is the universe of formlessness, and the third is the universe of form is emptiness and emptiness is form. The thing about this equates with the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. But that's dualistic, right? And Siddhiki Rishi used to say, but Dogen saved us by saying form is form and emptiness is emptiness. And I often wondered about that. He says the Heart Sutra says that, but I can never find it in the Heart Sutra. But Dogen wrote a fascicle, Hanya Haramitsu, which is a commentary on the Heart Sutra, and in that commentary, that's what he says. Mm-hmm. So, form is form, and emptiness is emptiness means form is just form, but when it's like they call it mu. Mu means no, right? In Chinese, or wu means no in Chinese. Mu means don't know in Japanese. Does the dog have the Buddha nature? No. Mu. But that mu is not the mu that's opposite of yes. It's not the no that's the opposite of yes. It's the no that includes yes. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a koan. So, a form is just form means there's nothing outside of form. Form includes emptiness. In other words, it's not that it includes emptiness. When you say form is emptiness, emptiness is form, there's still two things. So when you say form is form, it includes emptiness. So you're going to have to say so. In other words, it's that oneness. If emptiness is just emptiness and form is just form, then it's all included, the other is included. So that's actually the third sentence. You don't have to say form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And that's total inclusion. And that's where we're actually coming from. And realization is to realize that. It's easy to understand intellectually, but how do you realize that and practice it? Well, as well. What are you going to do? So it's time to end. Samantha decided what time we're going to be here next time. Don't you think? Okay, 7:15. Next time.